Okay, so actually, it's not clear how much time I have, but what I prepared to do is to have actually, you know, don't look at three boxes, but actually a small enough number of transparencies that I can go through them in 1 hour and a half. But if we have discussions, it can last longer than that, okay? So this is the plan. And how do you adjust the height? Well, is it focused enough?
Oh, you probably want to turn off the front lights. There's a switch right there. That switch. Turn off the front lights and on the back lights.
Oh, it's not working.
That's good. What if I want? What if you want to sleep?
Okay, I hope this is enough.
Can you see it there?
No.
Okay, well, so I'll start with, so the topic of the talk is about working memory. The first part will be about mechanisms. So starting with well-known concepts, but trying to implement them with more or less realistic properties of neurons and synapses and connectivity, and see, you know, what can come out of it. So I will emphasize two things, and you know, as you know, that. The general hypothesis is that stimulus-selective precision activity can be produced by recurrent excitations within a local cortical network. But of course, that should be balanced by inhibition. So I'll try to emphasize these two sides. So on one hand, I will discuss the role of NMDA receptors at recurrent synapses. For recurrent excitation. On the other hand, I'll show that, in fact, even in this system where recurrent excitation is very important, the recurrent circuit should be dominated by inhibition. Now, actually, I'll spend most of the time on what's called a spatial working memory, where you have to remember an analog quantity, like a position in space. And in that case, there are some spatial problems, and I will talk about two problems. One is that actually, how would you realize the what's called the Mexican hat kind of connectivity with realistic neurons and synapses? And I propose a radically different scenario where different kind of inhibitor neurons play different roles. And second issue about continuous system like this one for spatial working memory is that you want to have a continuum of, you know, attractors, each encoding a spatial location as a real number. And that assumes some kind of symmetry or translational invariance of the network, which is a problem if you say actually biological network is not homogeneous and it's very inhomogeneous. What do you do? Okay? The second part, after the first part about the mechanisms, I will talk about how such a circuit can actually be used to do some interesting computation. I will try to say that this is a different kind of network, very different from what we have been thinking for early sensory cortical areas. And you can use this kind of network to do computation. Namely, I will focus on what Michael Shadrin and Bill Newsom have done on perceptual decision making. Okay, so this is the plan. So just to introduce to you spatial working memory, and you know, stop me if you all know about this. So the basic experimental paradigm is to use primates, monkeys, In a delayed response task, where you, do I have this, some kind of pointer? There's one in the other room. But, okay. So I think Nicola talked about the object working memory, where, for example, the typical example is a delayed match to sample. You show a stimulus, and then delay, and then at the end of delay, show another stimulus, and the monkey has to indicate whether the second one is the same as the first one. And the monkey has to do that according to the memory of the first stimulus across the delay. So the analog of spatial working memory is that you train the monkey to fixate at the center of a screen, and during the stimulus, you know, a brief period of time, like half second, thanks. So you know, this is the screen that the monkey is supposed to be seeing, okay? And this is a time frame. That's cut in four epochs. This is before the stimulus, and this is during the stimulus, and then there's a delay, and then response, right? So during the stimulus, you flash a light spot somewhere on the screen, and then during the delay, the input is gone, but the monkey always fixates at the center of the screen, okay? At the end of the delay, the fixation point goes away. That tells the monkey that that's the end of the delay, and then monkey has to make eye movement to the location where the cue was presented before the stimulus. So presumably the monkey has to do this according to the memory where it was across the whole delay period, right? And so, I mean, it's really very well controlled experiment because the eye position is, you know, monitored and very well controlled. Now what people found is that in the prefrontal cortex, in the dorsolateral area, some neurons, you know, respond to the cue transiently. But some, you know, a big fraction of neurons that is turned on by a stimulus and keeps being on throughout the whole delay. This is a stimulus, this is a persistent activity during the delay, and then it's turned off. Some other neurons is only is active during the response period.
Gotcha. So this area is not a visual area, or is it?
Well, so it is the frontal. Is the visual area in the prefrontal cortex.
So the neurons they do get responsive to visual stimulus.
Yes, like this one, for example. Yeah. But
and the delay guy responds only after the cue is off, or there can be kind of continuation.
So there's a big variety of these kind of cells. Some neurons has already transient response during the cue, and then delay period activity. And many neurons actually turned on at the end of the cue, kind of slow. Okay, it takes time to turn on. And there are even neurons that really is turned on kind of hard way. You see some kind of ramping activity during the delay.
So this is as visual as like IT or the other?
Well, so first of all, they have. I don't think people have done that kind of experiments to map out. You know, for example, the stimulus selectivity. One example is that people actually debate about within the prefrontal cortex, which is one third of the neocortex, actually. Yeah, it's a huge thing. So you have to divide it into very many areas, right? So people still debate about whether a small area is doing the spatial thing and that other area is doing the object thing, for example. That's still a matter
of debate. So this area is due to the topic program.
Well, so what does, at least, well, they don't know, okay, but what they did do is to, for example, you can flash light from trial to trial at different locations.
Yes.
Neurons are tuned. So that's why the persistent activity is, you know, encodes information, the spatial location.
But just talking about the response, just in terms of the...
Well,
I'm just trying to get an idea of what kind of areas. Like in the other visual areas, so it's a more high level.
No, it's a very high level. This is a very high level. People still debate about whether there's a colonial organization in that area. There's no strong evidence.
Neighboring neurons, they may have.
They may have very different, yeah.
Anatomically, those areas are also very different from primary visual areas. Like dendritic arbors are huge there. Right. It can be 10 times bigger than, say, in V1.
So this is really, I mean, very high level area, which is kind of halfway between the sensory, early sensory area on one hand, and the motor area on the other hand. It's, you know, some.
There are some motor correlates.
There could be some motor correlates. For example, nearby, this is area 46, and nearby there's from the eye field, which, you know, if you do stimulation, you trigger eye movement directly.
So activating the delay period code for the position of the cube.
Yeah, let me show you this. So you can do this, as I say, randomly from trial to trial at different locations. In this case, with 8 cues, with the same fixed eccentricity. Okay, so this is the raster from my same cell, according to 8 different cues. And what you see is that this particular neuron, for example, it shows persistent activity only if the cue is around 225 degrees, like here. Right, so you can calculate the mean firing rate during the delay and plot this Gaussian kind of tuning curve.
But this would be also true for the response. The response is also true.
For this particular case, yes. But again, some other cells will not show response during the queue, okay. Only show the delay.
And vice versa.
And the vice versa, yes.
So that Gaussian thing is plotted on the basis of a single data.
Yeah.
That's right. So. You know, the thing is that some cells are really very sharply tuned. So if the, you know, if this is 45 degrees, then you basically only see one, or at most of two. You know, maybe one point here, one point there, and otherwise the cell will not be active. Actually, just to show you some variability of the tuning curve, and this, I think the first one is the same. But to indicate that there are some other kinds of neurons. So there are neurons that are, that show, so the dashed line here is the spontaneous activity between the stimulus, before the stimulus, okay? And this solid line is the persistent activity during the delay period as function of the cue location. Is that clear? So this is the one that I showed before. And one thing you notice is that even the highest rate is something like 30 hertz. It's not really terribly high, not like 200 hertz, for example. The other thing is that with no perfected cue, usually the delay period activity is lower than the spontaneous rate, all right, which is the dashed line. Now, the small fraction of cells show inverted tuning. So with some cue, the activity during the delay is lower, but will be more or less at the spontaneous level otherwise. Yet some other cells show no tuning, like this one, but show higher persistent activity during the delay compared to spontaneous state. Yes?
These cells are the regular spiking excitatory neurons?
They don't know.
They can't know from firing patterns which of the spike because of this fast spiking?
They don't know. I mean, this is done years ago. More recently, they did try to address this issue by looking at the spike wave forms. And as you know, that faster spike neurons seem to have much thinner spikes than regular spike neurons. So, you know, statistically, you can try to sort out the faster spike neurons, and I'll show you a slide of that. Okay? But at this point, they don't know. But what do they know is that this kind of inverted tuning curve cells is a small fraction, like 5% or something.
But it has never been observed that a cell in the prefrontal cortex would fire at a rate as high as cells would in V1, say, typically, under preferred stimulus.
Right. Usually it's like 30, 40 hertz at most.
But averaged over what time?
Over the whole delay period, yes.
I mean, it's the initial transient.
Right. The initial transient can be higher. Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
Because 3 to 6, no cells fire 200 hertz for 3 to 6 seconds. Anyway, right?
Right.
Yeah, V1 cell would adapt, for example, if you do it for long enough time.
Right. So would you say that they're similar in terms of just firing rates or not? Or is it slower?
Well, this is very hard to say because here, you know, it's during the delay period where there's no external input. You can't really compare with response to visual stimulus in V1. But the point is that the rate is low. It's quite low.
If you flash the stimulus in rerun, you also see some persistent continuation. Maybe not for medication, but just for half a second.
Right, but what may be an optimal stimulus for the rerun may not be an optimal stimulus.
Yeah, the rates. You can still compare the rates.
Yeah, there's actually a recent science paper showing some kind of persistent activity in V1. But they actually usually shows a, you know, a reduction in the delay period.
Reduction.
Lower than
what?
Than I think I think it's lower than the spontaneous state, but the spontaneous state is low, right? In V1. I'm not sure what the
it's low, very low. But if you flash the stimulus in V1, then for some time you respond.
Sometimes it's like 100 milliseconds or so?
Yeah.
But here, you know, the other thing is that you can actually change the delay duration from trial to trial, you know, this time 3 seconds, next time 6 seconds, and then, you know, this delay activity would change accordingly. You can also correlate, you know, just for fun of it, sometimes you can correlate, you know, the monkey's behavior by watching the delay period activity. So this is one cell that shows persistent activity when the monkey is supposed to remember the cue to the left, right? And those three trials are the correct trials. At the end of the delay, the monkey made the right eye movement. But in the next trial, at the end of the delay, the monkey actually made a mistake, and you go back to the spike training, you found out that the cell stopped firing in the middle of the delay. So that when the persistent activity is interrupted in this network, the monkey probably forgot where it was and then cannot guide the behavior response at the end of the delay.
According to the memory. This observation about forgetting, is there statistically significant data?
Yeah, so actually this is just one example. They actually did a statistical analysis, just, you know, summing up all this activity with the correct trials and error trials and see the difference. Yeah. All right, so we want to build a model of spatial working memory and reproduce this data from behaving monkey. And the model is based on the assumption that the persistent activity is sustained by recurrent excitation. There's different scenarios, actually, just, you know, because this is a little bit general talk, let me just flash out the possibilities for persistent activity. On one hand, you could imagine a big loop, right? For example, cortex can excite thalamus, and thalamus would excite back to the cortex, and that will give you sustained activity by recurrent excitation through a loop like this. Or you could have a loop between two cortical areas, like between prefrontal cortex and the parietal cortex, and that, you know, could also provide a recurrent excitation mechanism. But I think we know more about collateral connections within a local circuit, within a, you know, area, like inside here, like in area 46 in particular. But we should also not forget that the possibilities that intrinsic cellular properties the inward currents that are voltage gated could generate a recurrent excitation within a neuron. Right, but I'm going to focus mostly on this because of the existing data. So again, I think Nicola already talked about, you know, the basics of a working memory model for objects. So what I'm going to summarize about the model itself is to basically adopt that kind of approach, but using realistic synapses and neurons. Okay, so let me just mention two things. So you build a model like this. You take single neurons, pyramidal cells, and coverage interneurons from slice measurements, like I5 curve, time constants, and all that. You also do that from synapses. Okay, build a single synapses according to the measurements. I want to emphasize that in the cortex, there are two kinds of receptors that mediate excitation, two major ones. One is called AMPA receptors, which is very fast, with a decay time constant of 1 or 2, or maybe 3 milliseconds. On the other hand, NMDA receptor-mediated excitation is voltage-gated, so it's bigger with, you know, more depolarization, but also it has a much slower time course, so, you know, which can last, you know, the time constant can be 50 to 100 milliseconds. On the other hand, the inhibition is mostly mediated by GABA A receptors, which has time constant of, you know, 4 to 10 milliseconds, okay, somehow, somewhere between these two, which is going to be important.
Xiaojing, this is kind of similar to what this visual cortex model. Now, you just said we don't know if in the prefrontal cortex there is columnar organization, dark columns. So what you see here is say that neurons that are nearby, neurons that are, let's say, have
orientation, yes,
coupled together.
That's right.
This is kind of a hypothesis, or it's based on data?
This is a hypothesis. But this is David is talking about the connectivity now. So the connectivity is supposed to be a Gaussian shape with a, you know, spatial extent, the footprint sigma. And you do that for, you know, four kind of connections, E to E, E to I, I to E, I to I. So they are, you know, if you like, mostly characterized by, you know, each one is characterized by two numbers. One is the maximum, the other one is the width, right? Okay, and those are, you know, parameters. But this assumption does not, I mean, this does not necessarily assume columnar organization. It says that, right, it says that cells with seemingly preferred cues, for example, are likely be active at the same time and would, you know, connect to each other more by Hebbian kind of plasticity.
You also assume that the inhibitory neurons are tuned as well. For example, in the hippocampus, most of them show that the interneuron kind of are not tuned to space. And here you assume that an interneuron are tuned to
spatially.
Spatially.
Yeah, so that's going to be very important. Most of the time, we just assume that E to E is spatially tuned. And all these three other types are flat, okay, uniform. But there's a balance. So I want to emphasize that for all the things I'm going to show, I to I, for example, is important, as strong as, you know, I to E. Okay? But you will see that there will be a problems that sometimes we do need to include the other specially tuned connectivity to explain things.
Actually, to follow on David's question, from the wiring optimization point of view, this is the connectivity you assume, then you get a smooth map of orientation.
In visual cortex, but here,
well, it doesn't matter. Well, that's what I'm saying. If you use wiring optimization for this connectivity, you will get a map.
Okay, so, you know, again, the building blocks, neurons and synapses are from RAT V1 cortical slices, if you like. You know, assume that those building blocks are more or less the same, okay? And then the connectivity is reasonable. And then we ask, you know, what happens if we try to reproduce the monkey data for working memory? So you adjust those parameters for connectivity and reproduce the kind of data that was reported from monkey. And this is one example. What's shown here, well, I might as well show you all this. So what's shown here is time and network, right? Neurons are labeled by preferred cues. So each neuron has a preferred cue from 0 to 360 degrees. This is a raster, so each tick is a spike. What you see is that initially neurons fire spontaneously in a low firing background state. And then during the cue stimulus period, you present a spatially tuned stimulus, in this case around the center. All right?
This is
the model. Yeah. So you activate a group of cells here at the center, they now excite each other through recurrent excitation. So when the stimulus is gone, those guys can keep going, right? And what you can do is to just average across the delay for the network, you get this specially tuned activity profile. You can call that a bump state, right? This is like a bump in space. And then you can turn that persistent activity off during a response period. And how do you turn it off? Well, usually you would think that you turn it off from high state to down state by inhibition. It turns out that for this network, you can do that by excitation. So you just give a generalized excitation, so everybody fires a little bit more than usual, and that will turn off the network. And back to spontaneous state as before, you erase the memory. Okay? So in this special, simulation, in fact, the E to I connectivity is also tuned. So when you do the tuning curve of the, well, maybe let me.
So what is the burst of excitation turned on?
I'll get back to that point in a minute, okay? So now, if you do different kind of trials, so each time you present a stimulus at different locations, and so you would generate a bump state of this same kind of form, but peaked at a different location, okay? So the peak of the bump state encodes and remembers the cue, all right? So now, if you watch one cell, and you do this many trials at different locations, you can get a tuning curve for that cell, right? Okay, so you would get a tuning curve for pyramidal cells like this, for example. Where you see that the maximum is like 20 hertz in this case. And you can also get a tuning curve from interneurons, which is also tuned if E to I connectivity is tuned. And usually we get a tuning curve that's somewhat broader than pyramidal cells.
So, just want to understand more about the model. What is this model? You showed the result. And uniformly distributed cells over the
nation. The model is this, is a ring model, and at this point the network is uniform, homogeneous. Cells are identical.
What kind of
neurons? And most of the time we use interunifier neurons.
So
but yes. And I'll show you some examples of this conductance spacing model too.
And spontaneous activity will be to noise.
The input is, yes, there's some, there's a strong actually, I will show you, actually I plan to show you later. So there's a strong external inputs, which are noisy, Poissonian. Yes, and that that generates the that's right. So conceptually, it's a simple concept that you have bistability between a uniform low firing state and the family of bump states, right? And so the cue would trigger the network from the background state to one of the bump states.
So the integrated trial is potentially active in the absence of input?
In absence of?
Input.
No, so you assume that the network receives a lot of noisy inputs from the other area of the cortex, for example. Is the model clear? So when you do this,
so if it's uniform, why there was no drift?
I'll talk about there is drift.
No, we didn't see it.
Well, it's hard to see. It's hard to see this way. You know what you would have to do. I'll show you later. Well, this is the average across the delay, so you won't see it. But
what?
How do you see the drift? You mean you won't see this pattern kind of goes away from the center, right?
Yeah.
It's harder to see. I'll show you there is drift if you do population vector as function of time.
It should go far eventually. So you say it will take longer for him to drift, let's say, to the other orientation?
Yeah, it will take some time. So this is like, oh wow, this is like 4 seconds maybe?
So how long would you have to wait?
I'll answer your question in maybe half an hour.
Half an hour?
I talk about drift as a big issue.
Wait a minute, this is a long time. So what did some I don't understand this? You have a complete symmetry between the ridges. We have a lot of noise. It should be a strong drift. And you
should all time conduct what?
That's what I'm asking. There are no slow.
If the noise is not correlated, then you don't drift. So the drift goes
whatever, whatever square of that effect, right? So it'll be diffusive. Motion,
so this is very large network?
This is a relatively large network.
Why is it diffusive? There's no reason it should go right versus left, and that'd be random walk, right?
No, well, there are other people to it.
We do usually 2,000 or 4,000. Yeah. Right.
So, Cha-Ching, so this is a node, all fast synapses next to the
No, so this is actually all slow synapses. Okay. I'll get to that point in a minute. So just to show you before I get to the mechanisms, the network basically behaves, can reproduce the experimental data like this. So this shows the tuning curve from one cell in the model, and this is data from a prefrontal cortical neuron in the monkey, right?
So in the real animal, at these low firing rates, are the NMDA receptors actually active?
Yeah, so the point, well, so you jump really ahead, but the point is that that there's a lot of external input, right? So that makes the cell to actually be above the threshold and start to fire spontaneously. So in that case, the average membrane potential is high enough that, you unblock magnesium. You unblock the magnesium block of the NMDA conductance. All right. So what you need is the NMDA.
What is that voltage for?
What's the voltage level?
For half of the magnesium
block. Magnesium block. Magnesium.
Well, so it's pretty smooth curve. Actually, it's not very steep. If you use the Jair and the Stevens formula, for example.
What's the width?
I actually don't remember, but I think it's around minus 40. But it's pretty shallow. But do you remember?
60 millivolts about 10%
of the
level.
Okay. So in this network, both excitation and inhibition are important, right? So let me talk about one at a time. For excitation, we found that it's a lot easier to realize this kind of network in a stable way if the recurrent synapses have a lot of NMDA receptors. There's actually more than one reason for that. Let me just talk about one. The problem is that you want to have very strong recurrent circuit, okay? And excitation and inhibition both have to be really very powerful. As I mentioned before, if your recurrent synapses are mostly mediated by AMPA, they have a faster time constant than GABA-A-mediated inhibition. As a result, the network tends to be quite unstable. So an example is shown here, where you kind of change the ratio AMPA and NMDA, the recurrent synapses of the model, so that you have more AMPA component than before. What you start to have is that you still have persistent activity, right, during the delay period, but this persistent activity becomes synchronous. So if you blew part of this up, you would see the strong oscillations, and this is so-called local field, if you like, at the center, which shows oscillation at, in the gamma frequency range.
So this is fixing all parameters and
just changing the ratio. Changing the ratio AMPA and MDI at the recurrent synapses. We're preserving the sum, if you like.
Maybe other parameters.
Like what?
I don't know, how many parameters we have in this model?
So, the parameters are, as I said, you have four kind of connectivity, right? And each is characterized by the width and the height.
So
those are the eight parameters. And then there's the ratio AMPA and MDA, if you like.
Yeah, but you have amplitude of noise.
Yours have noise, yes. Well, that's right. So So you can say, what if I dump in a lot of noise? Maybe the oscillation will go away. Is that what you're thinking?
No, I don't have any intuition. You've got a system with tens of parameters, just varying one and saying something happens. Maybe you may find another change in the parameters.
It's possible. It's even possible that with different connectivities, you can have more than one dynamic regimes, for example, right? But we tried hard. You know, we can talk about this as we go along. But this just shows one example, if you like, where you just change the ratio ampere and MDA. When you have more ampere at the recurrent synapses, you start to see instability, right? And then
you make a general statement that any recurrent network with the excitation and emission with fast synapses becomes synchronized. You can put a statement to exhibit this faster synapse.
Well, the theory has to be more precise than that. But in general, I think the trend is certainly true. I mean, you can't always say this is the only possibility, but all you can say is that this is it's a lot easier to get instability if you have very strong recurrent network. Okay, so both excitation and inhibition are very strong. And you assume so that there's some kind of balance in terms of strength. And on the other hand, the speed is different. So excitation is faster than inhibition. Then the statement is that it's very easy to get instability. It's very hard to get stability.
Nicolas phase diagram of asynchronous and asynchronous activity.
Yeah, it's related to that.
But there was a whole region of asynchronous space.
Yeah, but so actually the phase diagram you mentioned, the time constants of excitation and inhibition was the same. So it's not. So here the fast ampere is much shorter than the time constant of the GABA.
And this makes a big difference. And this, and this is known that GABA is lower than.
So, I mean, actually, in general, yes. But you can always find a special case where the ratio is kind of close. The time constant for ampere and time constant for GABA A. But in general, it's a factor of 2 or 3 or 5. Or
5.
So tau GABA A. It's something like 4 to 10. And ampere is something like 1 to maybe up to 3.
So that's the cause of the problem. So if they were the same, you say that's
one. If they are the same, well, I'm going actually to show what happens when you change this. Yes, that's true. But I have to say that if you have some other feedback, you know, negative feedback mechanisms, like depression, for example, short-term synaptic depression, then the tau would be much longer.
Then what?
The tau for synaptic depression.
Yes.
And then again, you have this problem that excitation is much faster than inhibition, I mean, or negative feedback. Yes. And then you have the same problem.
Okay, can you quantify the strength in the GABA? I know it's difficult.
If yeah,
you
so.
The integral.
Right, right.
What, how much is the.
Yes, yes.
I'll show
a slide, okay? I'll show a slide.
About that last slide then.
Yeah.
Is that a finite end effect as n goes infinity, the oscillations go
up? No.
No.
How about heterogeneity? Is that?
Well, I'll talk about heterogeneity later. Okay. So one question you can ask actually is that maybe this depends on the fact that we use the integral firing neuron, right? The synchronization property actually is different when you use Hodgkin-Huxley kind of conductance space model or integral firing neuron. So we wanted to do it, you know, to try to find out what happens when you use conductance-based model, which is computationally more costly, but it's worth doing it. So this is one example where, you know, you just replace single neurons, the same kind of network architecture. You replace single neurons by, you know, conductance-based model. In this case, actually, pyramidal cells have three compartments with different kind of ion channels, and you can generate the same kind of behavior as before. So I want to tell you that there's a nice movie about this website. It's really kind of fun to watch.
Is MDA what you show here?
This is only NMDA, yes.
And now, the ratio of NMDA to AMBA.
So that, let me show you that, okay? So as I said, you have three regimes, if you like, when you change the ratio, AMBA and NMDA. So the way to do the ratio is actually, I mean, the neat way, the clean way to do it is to, for the voltage seen at rest, minus 65 or 70 for that matter, okay? So you suppose that you have one spike and you ask, what's the time integral of the AMBA current? Mm-hmm. And what's the time integral of the NMDA current? Mm-hmm. Okay? So that's the charge for the cell, and that's the ratio we talk about. Okay? Now, there are three...
If you clamp the voltage.
If you clamp the voltage, yes. At rest, for example.
But then at higher voltages, then those intervals will be different.
Well, at higher voltage, yes, this will be different because the you multiply this by a number, which goes with voltage. So there are three regimes. One is that if NMDA, say, if AMBA is zero, for example, at the recurrent synapses, then the network is asynchronous. Okay, this is one regime. Present activity, asynchronous activity. Now, if you have more AMBA, you have a smaller NMDA AMBA ratio, then you start to see synchronous activity, but you still see present activity, okay? And then at the end, if there's too much AMBA, you lose present activity. So this is a summarizing diagram, form conductance-based model, where we change the tau for gamma A. Okay, you just look at one of them first, 10 milliseconds, okay? So this is the ratio, NMDA, actually this is the percentage, it doesn't matter. So the higher is this number, the more you have an NMDA, right? So in this case, for example, the green corresponds to asynchronous state, yellow synchronous percent state, and the blue you lose percent activity. Right?
What happens when you lose it?
You just collapse back. Because the fluctuation is so strong that in the middle, you just collapse back to spontaneous state.
So there's a big burst and then inhibition comes in and discharges everything off.
That's right. Okay, so what you see here is that when tau gamma A is 10 milliseconds, you need a fairly large percentage of NMDA to get asynchronous state, and also fairly large percentage to get synchronous state even. But if you reduce the tau, this border goes down and this border goes down, right? That means that, I mean, as you expect, when tau for gamma A is shorter, then you have more stability and you don't need as much in NMDA.
So Nicola, you get persistent state with So what is inconsistent with?
And there is also another thing is that when you go to the squares, so when the fraction of norms which are becomes very small, then the activity doesn't affect too much the rest of the network. So you tend to get less instability.
So conductivity here is all to all?
Yes.
Well, we can argue about precisely what the boundaries are, but the general point that adding NMDA makes the
network
less likely to synchronize, have synchronized
oscillations.
That's
but the question is how, if there is a real problem.
But there is NMD anyway, and so.
No, so, I mean, we can ask the question
it's,
like.
It's unrealistic to make the model with just F anyway. So, why does it matter?
It for some others.
Well, yeah.
Okay, let me show you.
So the issue of all-to-all connectivity.
So, right, so you can ask what happens if you use sparse connectivity, right? I'll kind of touch that point. We have not done that yet, but I'll talk to you when I talk about the heterogeneity. So another thing is that if you have a slow inward current in single cells, like in this case, you have what's called calcium-activated ICAN. Well, how it works is that, you know, actually people have seen this current in prefrontal cortical pyramidal cells of the rat. What happens is that when you activate the cell, you accumulate calcium into the cell, which in turn would slowly activate an inward current, right? So as a result, for example, in this case, the cell would show a little bit, you know, persistent activity, you know, just it would keep going a little bit when the current slowly decays back to baseline, and the time scale here is half second. So
what
you have,
what is ICAN?
So it's a calcium activated canyon, current, so non-selective sodium potassium current, which is seem to be voltage independent. So it's an inward current.
It's calcium activated non-selective.
That's right. And it's the voltage independent inward current.
Okay.
It's very slow. So
I never asked you also here before. So experimentally, is there agreement on what the ratio is of AMPA and NMDA? I hear all kinds of numbers.
Yeah, me too. So it's actually a very hard thing to do, turns out.
Why is it so hard? Dual intercellular coding exists in sky space?
Yeah, but you have to, for example, you have to decide what voltage you look at.
Sure.
You know, and nobody has done that as function of voltage, for example. And you really have to do it with a dual intracellular recording, you know, connected pairs. But most of people actually didn't do that. They just stimulate extracellularly and see what you see.
How come when I saw some data on the slices, the voltage curve, I've never seen this slow
curve? Because this is extremely noisy. So this actually, if you look at the peak, this is like 1% of that. So I didn't do this on scale. So it's very noisy.
See that because of noise?
It's very noisy, and this is like 1% of this. But because it's so slow, in fact, the charge is significant.
But even if you average, you should see.
Yeah.
There are papers that show it.
Right.
Yeah, but I saw something with my own eyes. I never see slow cards.
Well, another thing is that
they didn't block them.
Huh?
I'm sure they didn't block them.
Maybe you unblock a little bit of magnesium or raise a little bit of voltage.
If Henry
did it, right, rest maybe too small.
If it was 80, then
right.
So they, okay, so I'm not supposed to see.
All these issues. So if you have this slow inward current, actually in a way you can substitute this, NMDA component by this. Okay, so that's what's shown here. So the NMDA AMPA ratio would go down, required for stable network behavior, would go down if you have stronger current in the single cells. Right? But again, the point is that you need some positive feedback which is slow compared to negative feedback. The answer to Sebastian's question is not there yet, but let me show you one very indirect but interesting data, which is the messenger RNA expression of NMDA receptor 7.
You had all-to-all homogeneous population,
yes.
And the external inputs were also homogeneous.
Yes.
So every neuron was the same.
It's Poisson.
This is all so very good for synchrony. So if you say this is a problem, why didn't you relax it all?
I'll get to that point. Heterogeneity is a big issue. Okay, I'm going to talk about it. So let me just finish this part, showing you a messenger RNA expression slide, where you just ask, what's the amount of messenger RNA which encodes the expression of subunits that make up NMDA receptors, right? A NMDA receptor is made up of one NR1 subunit plus one or two NR2 subunits. And NR2 has A, B, C, D, four flavors, all right? So I think what's kind of impressive, this is the human, is that if you compare primary visual cortex, parietal cortex, motor cortex, and prefrontal cortex, prefrontal cortex has a lot higher NMDA receptor and messenger RNA expression than the other areas.
What are the numbers?
They kind of, they do the counting. They count how many grams, what they call inside a cell. coming, you know, little things. And the number is that per cell, basically.
Grains of what?
So that, you know, gives you a quantitative measurement, but indirect quantitative measurement about the amount of messenger RNA expression.
Like per cell?
Well, for the reason I ask is because I don't understand what the grain is. You know, grain can be of different size.
So is this some kind of, they stain it? Some immunohistochemical assay?
That's right.
And then they have little pixels and they count how many pixels light up?
Yeah. So I don't know about the size, but.
It's like mRNA.
Yeah,
it's
for proteins. This must be, this is expression data.
No, so this is not for proteins. And that's another issue, right? So you can ask, what really is the amount of proteins, the subunits themselves, and not the messenger RNA? But of course, the right way to go is to really do physiological recordings to find out.
So this is
not
something per cell.
I did not find this such a nice quantitative measurement.
Because if
cells can
make
yes,
many
that's right.
Then you would expect that everything should scale up.
It's possible, yeah. So there is unfortunately there's no real, I mean, as good quantitative measurement as this one for AMPA.
So it would be interesting to see prefrontal cortex knockouts.
Yeah. Right. Okay. I actually should have had a flip slide where a Japanese group, Tanji, did ontophoresis of the behaving monkey. Okay, the same kind of task as Goldman Fisher has. But then you put the electrode into the prefrontal cortex, you try to block either AMPA or MDA receptors very locally, you know, in around a few cells. And what he claims is that the NMDA blocker is much more effective at, abolishing the person activity than the AMPA in terms of the amount of current he has to get in. But I think that kind of experiment is kind of worth doing. All right, so this is about excitation. And how about inhibition? It turns out that even if the persistent activity, which happens usually locally, right, in a subpopulation of cells at a time, is strong, the whole network actually is dominated by inhibition. So one way to show this is to calculate individual components of the current that a cell would see before.
Before you show this, what do you actually mean?
What?
Explain us what do you mean that it's dominated.
That's what I'm showing here. So you look at one cell, right? You just look at different currents to that cell. External, recurrent excitation, recurrent inhibition, right? And the blue is before the kill, spontaneous state. And red is during the delay period when the stimulus is optimal. Right? So let's look at blue first. So this is the external input, depolarization, excitation up. Recurrent excitation is this way. Recurrent inhibition is this way, right? So if you do the sum of the two, actually the total recurrent input is inhibitory, right? So the idea is that the external input is very strong, and I think that's already in Amit and Brunel's model, that you assume that the external input is very strong, and the recurrent network is dominated by inhibition, so the total recurrent input actually is negative.
This is
during the spontaneous state, okay? But the total sum, of course, the grand total is positive and the cell fires, right? Now, after the stimulus, during the delay period activity, you have much stronger recurrent excitation, right, to sustain the persistent activity. But you also have a bigger recurrent inhibition from, feedback. And the sum of the two is still, almost, zero, but you're still a little bit negative.
But it could be fluctuation, or it can be dependent parameter
of whatever. Yeah, it's possible, but
you described your simulation. This is what happens in your simulation.
Yes.
So what do you mean for this?
But the one set parameter can be a little bit small d below, and the other type of parameter can be small d up.
Should we say balances?
Yeah, it's balanced. Sure. You mean this can be a little bit positive, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, maybe balance is a better way than dominance.
But not in the terms of Sobolinsky.
No, well, not in a technical sense, but maybe.
Because there the balance was actually more in the
tight, right.
Because the external input was very strong, so the network had to. Right. So here the network doesn't do much, doesn't do much.
The voltage step would be close to the balance in this sense.
Right, so this is closer to Carl and Hamm's regime, when inhibition dominates.
Sure, I don't understand something basic. So total is the sum of exciter and inhibitor?
Total is exciter, inhibitor, and external.
And external.
Yeah, and that makes it positive.
So external No. That's the total, but total current is the refund.
Yeah, this is the sum of the two.
Well, but it's not. Yeah, I don't understand. I mean, this is, you know, the inhibitor is minus one, and exciter is 0.4. You add them
up. Oh, yeah, actually, yeah, the number doesn't matter. let's see.
That's how you quantitate it on this.
Okay.
Yeah, right.
I thought I didn't understand something.
No, you're right.
So
this one is wrong. It should be the sum of these two.
So this should be bigger.
Yeah.
Minus 6. Four. So this should be.
But then the total is zero.
The total is zero.
Total is zero. We draw the inhibitor from smaller.
This
draws the inhibitor from smaller.
Maybe this should be smaller. Right.
But then it's not inhibitor, it's related.
No, so this sum should be still this.
So this is a. Okay. It's total.
Yeah, this should be right. And so this should be wrong.
But this is not like in Carl's model. Carl's model, the total recurrent is about as strong as external. It has a negative sign, because it has to undo it.
It's strong enough to bring the network close to threshold, right. Which is what you see here. Because threshold is about
4.4. Yes, right. Threshold is around here. So this, you're barely below threshold.
Threshold is, okay, so here you have external input with just above threshold.
So it is like Carl's.
And in Carl's, it has to be much stronger than threshold. By a factor of square root of K. In order for the whole thing to work.
I thought the average was at threshold.
No, but the external input has to be much, much stronger than threshold.
Right.
And here you have external input, which is just above threshold. So it's really.
This is the sum of all currents and all neurons?
Yes.
Okay.
That's pretty strong. So external input stays on throughout the key period, right?
Say it again?
External input stays on throughout?
Yes. The whole time. It doesn't change.
But if I looked at a single neuron, then it'll be different, right?
No, this is a single neuron, actually.
It's a single neuron, or
yeah.
Is
this? You just want, you know.
It's optimal. This is for.
Oh, it's optimal, okay.
When the stimulus is optimal. Okay, so I talked about, I mentioned briefly the tuning of the neurons. So in fact, let me show you this again, that the tuning of the neurons is usually somewhat broader. We couldn't get, you know, the network to work if the tuning of the neurons is as narrow as pyramidal cells, just numerically. We don't have a theoretical justification for that. But it turns out that people actually try to differentiate fast-specking putative interneurons from pyramidal cells in the experiment by the spike shape. And what they seem to have found is that, in fact, the putative interneurons usually do show a broader tuning curve. So this is actually data from monkey prefrontal cortex, where you show that typically the tuning of putative fast-specking neurons A fast spec neuron shows a broader tuning than pyramidal cell. Yes, that's right. Okay, so now, actually it turns out that when we do conductance-based model, we realize a problem with this model. The problem is that usually you want to have a bump state.
Just another question about the one. So your connections are all perfectly tuned.
Yes.
Because if you had some offset, you could be able to have inhibitor neurons also sharply tuned.
Yeah, you mean if you have a hole or something. Yeah, so if connectivity is not centered.
Yeah, not precisely centered. That probably, because all you want is somehow to sharpen the bump. You break up an additional work a little bit.
Yeah, if you create a hole, so basically you really want to have, you want to have, you know, E to I, for example, to instead of showing this, for example, you want to show something maybe like this, right? Yeah, that's one possibility. But let me, well, you can't just shift this because you can't shift in one way. You want to do it in a symmetrical way. Yeah. But let me stay with this scheme first and see what's the problem with conductance space model, which you will not see with integrand fire. So basically what you want is that, you know, if you go through the mean field kind of analysis, you won't end up with some kind of rain model where the overall connectivity, you know, the input to the cell has a Mexican head, right? So for example, you can have excitation current narrowly tuned, an inhibitor current, you know, more broadly tuned, you sum them up, you get something like this. Or you can have inhibition flat and you get something similar, right? That's the usual thing with how we do it, right? Now the problem is that, in fact, it's not the connectivity scheme, the static connectivity scheme that counts. It's really the dynamical current that counts. When you look at the current with conductance-based model, you have the conductance times V minus reversal potential. For example, reversal potential is minus 75 millivolt. And this is the voltage of the PM the cell, of course, you look at, right? Now, let's look at a simple case when this G is constant. So for example, I to E is flat, right? So this is a constant, and then G will be a number. But the problem is that the voltage is a function of theta, which depends on the firing rate of the cell at theta, right? And it will actually go up with a higher rate, usually. Right, so the average voltage would go up with the firing rate, usually. So basically, it is when the cell fires at a higher rate, the average maximum potential is higher. Okay, as a result, the difference between this and the VI is bigger. Yes? And so it turns out that this difference is maximum at the peak. And it's as nearly tuned as the bump itself. Just because of this fact.
The NMDA current should also be tuned.
The NMDA current also has the same thing, yeah. Right. But the thing, the point is that actually when you look at the current, you really don't get the broadly tuned thing. Instead, you get the same, you know, you don't get this. You never get that. You just get something that has, you know, also has the same shape, which makes it very hard actually to find a stable bound solution. Do I get this across? For example, you don't.
The inhibitory current is tuned for the same orientation as exhibitory.
Yeah, but it's as narrow as. Because the bump itself. How do you get a broader component?
Because of the connectivity.
No, this is.
Well, that's assuming flat
connectivity. Yeah, so what's broader than flat connectivity?
Yeah, but during the spike itself, mostly, inhibition doesn't matter too much because during the spike, the internal properties matter. And below this pipe, that depends on the HP or ADP or how, it really depends on the details of the model, how much HP you have and so on.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that what matters is the average V.
Correct.
During spiking. And that usually in cortical PMDA cells usually goes up with the rate. That's the simple thing. Sorry?
You cut off the spike, it shouldn't be that big.
Sorry?
HP. You cut off the spike, and you average the voltage without the spike, it should actually go up.
It still goes up. It still goes up. I mean, it still goes up. So, but the point then.
How much? We're talking tens of millivolts?
Yeah, but it's big. A 10 is big enough.
In the solo.
Right.
But this is an issue of how much is inhibition shunting at rest, right?
you're starting out with basically shunting inhibition.
Right, so you can ask how does that depend on the value you choose here, right? But this is actually, so it's already a, you know, certainly a difference of time interval also, right? What should I do? Should I keep going on this part? I haven't addressed the issue of heterogeneity, and okay, let me give you a more complicated model, but just show two slices, okay? So the idea to solve this problem, I think it's a real problem with conductance space model, is to introduce different kind of GABAergic neurons, which would create a disinhibition of dendrite. So let me just tell you, I mean, briefly, that there are several kinds of interneurons. There's the GABAergic cells that, you know, the basket cells we typically think about that project broadly to pyramidal cells. So think about this as columns, right? And this is one pyramidal cell in this column.
But the NMDA current will compensate for that. The voltage dependence of the NMDA will compensate for that inhibition.
We have not done really, this is a conductance-based model, so we want to do mean fields to understand fully the model. But the point is that inhibition current, inhibitor current is as narrowly tuned as excitation. That creates a problem.
That bug will get, you could argue the excitatory current will just balance that out. There'll be a corresponding increase in the excitatory current.
But I don't think it's easy to get a stable bump if you don't have side, you know, inhibition, so to speak, right? That's the point.
This could come from productivity.
You mean something like that, for example. In essence, we are proposing something like this, but in a more complicated way. So the idea is to create a hole here at the center. You create a disinhibition at the center somehow, right? Based on some data, we propose to do it this way. Okay, so you have three types of interneurons. This is just broadly tuned, broadly projecting neurons. It's called PV positive. It doesn't matter. Okay, so you have three kinds of interneurons. But the other two kinds are, you know, really narrow. The dendrites and axons are within a column. And what the CR kind of interneuron does is to inhibit the CB interneuron, which usually inhibit the dendrite.
So the CR, CB, PV is part of the avenue. It's a fast spider cell.
Yes. Yeah.
What are the CB and CR?
So CB, sometimes people call LTS interneurons.
CB or LTS.
Like Barrichonis and histidine.
Okay.
Right?
And CR?
CR is carandining positive. People don't know much about the physiology, but sometimes people call that irregularly firing, clustering firing. You know, maybe, you know, cluster firing cells that Macron, for example, is measuring.
You should already say that they're firing intermittently.
Yes, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah, those are the CR cells. There's some evidence that, curiously, CR cells actually don't project to, for example, to PV cells. They like to project to interneurons, no pyramidal cells. I think actually no pyramidal cells, just to CB cells. Okay, so basically the idea is that CB cells usually inhibit dendrite, and that gets blocked by CR locally. That will create a hole for inhibition, and that would in effect realize this kind of connectivity, as Misha was suggesting.
So the PV cells are broadly tuned; they connect. They just have a flat.
CB.
The bottom ones.
PV. PV. Basket cells project broadly. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So now let me move on to the issue of heterogeneity. Which means here. You know, the issue about heterogeneity goes like this, right? So this is a spatial working memory model. As I said, you encode and remember the cue by the peak of the bump, which says the population vector of the bump state, right? The assumption is that you want to encode any position as a real number, so you need a continuum of bump states. And that usually is realized by translational invariance in the network, in a homogeneous network. But indeed, you see random drifts, right? Because when stimulus is gone, nothing really holds the bump against the noise, so the noise starts to drift randomly. What's shown here is the population vector. So each trace is a population vector position, right? Which, if you like, is the memorized queue as a function of time. So you start at the same queue across different trials. What you see is that you start to drift away, right? And the standard, the variance of this drift grows more or less linearly with time, like a diffusion process. And the problem is less severe, you have a bigger network, as you expect, if the noise is uncorrelated from cell to cell. But you would still expect this kind of thing if actually the noise is correlated.
So the simulations mm-hmm. show this was a big network. That's why we didn't see a drift.
Yeah.
There's no jump, it just should go like one of a square root, but yes.
Why is there such a big difference between 2000 and 4000? It's an example of average. This is
actually average, so this is the number of trials. But why is such a big difference?
Yeah, it's not clear.
Looks like something happened here, so that you don't have a drift.
Right, we did not, so one thing one could do is to just plot the slope as a function of the...
Yeah, it looks like there is nothing.
Well, there may be a very shallow slope.
But should be this vector too.
Well, if you go from here to here, yeah.
It's also a bit different, but it's even more striking that it disappears.
Well, if you look at this, clearly there's some drift, okay? So you, if you go here, compare this point and this point, yes. but you're saying actually maybe it starts to saturate somehow here at this time point. It does not grow much, you know.
So you should wait long enough.
This is only two.
Well, what are the error bars for n equals 15?
Right. No, that's not. It's not showing.
You need some error bars.
Right.
Yeah, but they're pretty small, right? I mean, it says
12 degrees. What? A equals 15? I don't know. It's not going to be that small.
But it's going to be in the order of 10 degrees, right? Or less, because at least at 2 seconds. That's 6 seconds. Yeah.
Well, here, this is 500, so you can really see that.
How can that be 500? Good. That's 20 degree mark.
Squared.
Oh,
right.
Maybe they try to see if there is a drift in the experiment.
Well, so if you look at the precision with which the circuit is made, you actually see something. So this is an example where, so this is just the I position after the circuit, right? And this is zero delay, and this is a delay of 3 seconds, and this is a delay with 6 seconds. You still clearly see that with a longer delay, you see more scatter. But that's monkey, right? That's the behavior. So
So
the question really is how do you relate this to neural activity, and that's something we're starting to look at from data. Can you really quantify drift at the neural activity level, and then might be correlated with drift?
But it's not clear that the space in that experiment should be continuous because they've been trained on 8 directions, 4 months.
Right, so that's
no reason that they should be.
That's another issue. So we ask them to do this experiment, but you just train the monkey with some number like 8, and then you just in the test, you can just show any cue, right? That really need to be done.
Yeah, I mean, you'd expect that if it really was just underlying storage was discrete, then they would categorize.
Right. That's certainly.
You should trade that property to avoid this.
You can, yeah, but I guess they you can't do that if you want to have your own data because you don't have enough trials.
No, during the training.
For different queues.
For training.
Oh, for training, yeah.
You also have training different R's. I mean, it's probably really a 2D map, not a 1D.
So that's another thing. People, you know, like Earl Miller did, you know, stimuli at different eccentricity. So basically in 2D. And you get something like this, basically. Just, you know, you really should imagine a bump in two-dimensional space, right? Like place cell kind of tuning. Yeah.
But in 2D, all the drift by already.
The drift would be different, yeah. So, okay, one way, another way to see a homogeneous state is that you don't start with the same queue, but at different queues, right? So you try to remember the queue location, and this is population vector again. So what you ask is that at the end of the delay, say 6 seconds, am I around the queue location or not? You know, in this homogeneous network, you know, it's pretty much close, right? You know, plus minus a little drift, right? Is this clear, the plot? So you start with different queue. This is actually 1,000 network.
1,000 is so huge delays.
6 seconds delay.
Six seconds.
Well, you do see, sorry, you see.
Can you put the leaders?
Well, you have to be careful actually to see if you can compare this two, because I think we did this with two slightly different parameter sets. So I think those two don't agree. So this is one cell.
Yeah, yeah, it goes completely in the way.
Right. Yeah, in fact, I think this parameter has less drift than this parameter set. So it does depend on, for example, if you increase the recurrent excitation and the recurrent inhibition a little bit, so that the bump is narrower, and then it will be more localized.
We have to look at the first 2 seconds of this. Well, that's the same.
This is 6 seconds.
Yeah.
So these are homogeneous or heterogeneous
network? This is a homogeneous network.
It might depend on how much noise you injected too, right? It might depend on how much noise you injected.
Yeah, it does. Right. But for, you know, so what I'm going to talk about, it's fixed the noise level.
But these simulations may have had different noise than those, or? Michelle was asking why there's a difference.
I think the difference mainly is because of the slight different parameters with recurrent excitation inhibition. By 5 to 10%. So the question is, in the real biological cortex, neurons and synapses connections are heterogeneous. For example, if you plot a FI curve of pyramidal cells, you know, you plot 10 FI curve, you get, you know, all kind of relationships. So if the model depends on heterogeneity, I mean, the assumption that network is homogeneous, how can it work in the presence of heterogeneity? So we started to look at this issue, and to begin with, let's start with modest heterogeneity, okay? So you just have a resting voltage with a mean of minus 70 millivolt and a standard deviation of 1 millivolt. Actually, what I'm going to show in the next slide is the same as I showed before, but with heterogeneity and with 1,000 cells. You know, what happened is that now you create some, you know, biased regions in the cortex, in the network. Yeah, this is a ring model.
Random heterogeneity, quench random heterogeneity.
Yes.
And this result, how much does it depend on n? I expect if n.
Yes, I'll show that in a minute. So this is one example which what you see is that you start with different queues and they kind of converge to two privileged, you know, biased regions and where the, you know, the, this little subpopulation of cells are more excitable than the rest of the network, okay, for these two locations. And so if you wait, you know, for 6 seconds and you ask what was the Q, you kind of, you know, all you can tell is one of the two, but you can't really remember other locations. So how do we study the dependence on the network size? So we did it in two different ways, actually. Let me just show you one way. One is through the mean field. Okay, so this is the same simulation as before, but in the mean field model, where you don't have noise. You start at different locations again, and the population vector converges in this particular example actually to three possible attractors. What's kind of interesting is that if you look at, you know, you draw a line here, you see that the speed of drift is the same, okay, at each theta, right? So if you look at theta, the speed of the drift is constant. So as a result, you have a unique speed for each theta, right, for the drift. So you can, you know, just calculate that speed. And then you can consider this, you know, as a particle in physics, where this is the position and this is the velocity. And then you integrate one more time, you get the potential with a minus sign, right? So, you know, just show you an example like this. So you calculate the speed as a function of theta, you get this kind of curve. And you integrate one more time, you get a potential. What?
So you do it from this, you do simulations many times.
So you do that, well, no. So actually, you actually do this for each realization of the sample. And you get a different potential, right? This is with quenched noise, right? Quenched heterogeneity. So you get this potential for each realization. Now you can talk about
to get the curve, you have to do just one simulation.
Oh, you do many simulations in the mean field. Yeah. Yes.
Many,
yes. That's right.
You say you integrate. What exactly do you integrate?
So you just look at the drift speed, right?
Yes.
Let me show this once more.
Ah, you assume there is some potential, and then you
Well, you can assume that. You can assume that only if the speed is unique.
Is the gradient of the potential.
That's right.
So this is one realization, many realizations of the noise. One quantity.
This is one realization.
And many
so
quantity.
You have to do it with each time. You have to do it separately.
But for each time, each quantity realization of the heterogeneity, you do it with many realizations of the noise. No.
There's no noise in this case. Doesn't mean field. Yeah. This is symmetric drift, yes. Okay, you know, so this is what we call a theta model for the drift, systematic drift. If you want to compare this theta model from the mean field.
Why is it smooth? You get a smooth curve, but your noise is, your wedge disorder is relative.
Right. Well, okay. So we did this with a fixed, I mean, a discrete number of Qs. You get discrete number of points, right? And then you extrapolate between points.
Neurons get correlated with the excitation spread. Doesn't the synaptic connectivity kind of filter everything out?
Yeah. So that's filtering of this wedge noise because of connectivity.
Yeah, connectivity is not totally random. Connectivity is. Nearby neural
connectivity. Wait, but I don't understand. So can you remind me again what those lines are actually? Is that the average?
No, so this is just, so this is a population vector, right? So you start here, for example, you start one Q, you say, this is my spatial location you should remember, right? And then the population vector try to remember it, but it drifts away because of the heterogeneity.
Okay, so can you repeat the answer to the question? Why isn't that line noisy?
Oh, this is because this is a mean field calculation.
Okay, so you have several realizations, one realization.
This is one realization of the heterogeneous parameters.
Yes. Right, but several realizations of.
There's no noise in the mean field. Okay? So you can add noise back if you want afterwards.
You have noise in the simulation.
Yes, of course. Yeah, right. You can add the noise back after you're done. So you can have, you know, you can have equation, which is the theta model. Theta prime is the derivative of the potential with respect to theta, and then you can add some noise if you want, so that you get something that's like the real, okay, original network. This is actually one example of that, theta model with noise. Okay, finally, I can answer your question about the scaling with network
no
size.
To get this potential without doing the simulation.
So there's another way. So that's the second way I just mentioned briefly. It turns out that what matters is not the precise distribution of the heterogeneity, it's the convolution of that with something that looks like a bound, you know, shape. So you have something that looks like this, which is the synaptic conductance profile, for example. Mm-hmm. Sorry, let me say that.
I think you can do it perturbatively. You can calculate this thing perturbatively, right? Small disorder.
You can actually get
an empirical fit, or this convolution model is just an empirical fit.
It's empirical, but it works pretty well.
But even analytically, can you get it just perturbatively from your mean field?
You perturbation in it?
No, you're adding a small disorder onto the property.
It's possible. I don't know.
Okay, anyway, go on, sorry.
Yeah, so if you do the heterogeneity convolved with this, then you get very good, you know, estimate of the potential. Okay, and then once you have this.
But this should depend on W of U.
Yes, whatever.
It will. Let me show you. This is the slide I'm going to show you. Dependence on the neural network size. So you want to quantify that to show that you want to get a number, okay? Plot a number as function of network size. The number we plotted is the average speed of the drift, systematical drift. Okay, just calculate the average speed, basically the average of this, right? Okay, and across theta. Look at this curve first. So this is the case when you have heterogeneity only in the leak potential. So what you see is that, you know, it does go down with network size. Kind of interesting, when you do log-log plot, the slope is not minus one, but minus half.
How could mean speed means, so speed means absolute value or equation velocity?
Yeah.
Absolute value.
Yeah.
Because if you do the mean square,
So this is the mean, right, so this would be...
The mean velocity would be, the mean of d theta dt would be zero.
Right, so you do this, and then average over theta. Okay? And it goes like 1 over square root of n.
Do you expect it to be 1 over n?
Well, so Cousin Zhang, for example, look at this issue.
Who?
Cousin Zhang. Look at the issue of a high direction cell model, you know, basically it's a bound Machado network, where he has heterogeneity in the connectivity. And he showed that in that case, it's 1 over n.
How about the variance in the speed when it goes 1 over n? Variance of the velocity when it goes 1 over n. So he'd say the variance of velocity goes 1 over n squared?
That's how I remember.
The variance, because he probably did the variance, not the absolute value. I mean, I don't know if it matters, but does it matter? Would it matter?
Yeah, I would say the variance goes 1 over n and the time that's square root of that goes 1 over n. Who knows how the absolute value goes?
No, I think it's different. But
what statistic did he use?
What statistics?
Which did he use?
Yeah, he actually used this, something like this.
The variance or the absolute value?
I remember it's the speed. It's absolutely right.
The bag is probably saying it could be good, right?
Now, another thing I want to mention is that if you just have a little bit more heterogeneity, okay, in the threshold, for example, in the capacitance, or in the reset, this goes way up. So those points correspond to the case when you have a little bit more heterogeneity than just in the leak.
It will still
follow that kind of trend, but the point is that you can't solve this problem, I don't think, just by saying that you have big enough network. If you have reasonable heterogeneity in the cells, you have to face this problem. You can't just say because your network is big enough.
And I think for the balance network, the heterogeneity giving an order one effect. For the balanced network, if you have heterogeneity and connectivity, then you get an order one effect, independent of it, because of the balancing issue. Whereas Carl, you need, ask Carl about this.
I don't see why. I mean, this is heterogeneity in the single cell properties. It's not connectivity.
Okay, but.
Anyway, okay, so I think I'm running really behind. Let me just show you one way that maybe we can fix this problem. So this was motivated by an experiment done by Gina Turgeno at Brandeis. What they found is that in the culture of slices, if you just pharmacologically reduce the excitability of the cell, reduce the firing activity actually of the cell, for example, using TDX, then you wait for long enough time, you come back, you measure the EPSC, you find that the size is increased, okay? On the other hand, if you enhance the activity for some time, and you go back, 2 days later, you find that the EPSC is reduced. And what they found is that it looks like the EPSCs that you see from a cell all scale up and down by the same factor, and that's shown here when you look at the cumulative probability. So the hypothesis is that maybe there's some mechanism inside the cell that can reach some kind of a homeostatic state, and if you have too much activity, the synapses would scale down, and if you have too little activity, the synapses would scale up. And so that you can reach some kind of fixed overall activity level across many days. So that sounds like an interesting scenario where we can probably use, which we can use to kind of homogenize the network in the presence of heterogeneity. So the idea is that this is just formalizing that idea. So if this is the firing activity of the cell, this is the goal that the cell firing rate has to reach, averaged over many days. And this is the scaling factor for the synapses. So if the firing rate is higher than the goal, then G will go down. And if firing rate is lower than the goal, then G will go up until this steady state will be reached. Okay? So then the idea is that...
Why scale the G itself?
Because that's the scaling factor. Okay? So the idea is that when you have heterogeneity, some neurons, some regions of neurons, a neural network is more excitable than the other. Okay?
But now, you could have it without, you could have it additive instead of multiplicative. Is the point that you don't want GI to become negative? Or there's an extra factor GI there?
That's right.
So,
like doing it for log G instead of for G.
It scales down the increment as GI goes closer to zero.
Right, but you want the change. You also depend on the G value at the moment.
So one reason I can think of that is
so that's why it's multiple scaling.
GI becomes small, then the change is smaller. As GI approaches zero, the change is smaller. So
right.
You can never end up with a negative
that's
GI.
Right.
So.
Yeah. But again, I mean, data also shows this is multiplicative, not just additive. Okay. So the idea is that imagine the monkey is doing nothing but just doing this spatial working memory task. Okay, with the same probability, the monkey would see, queues randomly but with equal probability. So then, when some region of the network is too excitable, it will always attract, the population vector, and then that's too much excitability in that region, and this thing will scale the synapses down, okay, and make that region less excitable, and vice versa. So, without going into details, should I skip details?
So you simulated this
type. We did this with the spatial working memory
model. And it does help to reduce the queue, or to break it.
That's right. So this is an example. Just show you one example. This is a homogeneous network. This is a heterogeneous network before scaling, and this is a heterogeneous network after scaling. And the network behaves.
This mechanism can correct any homogeneity.
Say it again.
This mechanism can correct any homogeneity, not only just whatever it puts.
That's right. So let me show you one.
But this is trying to scale all the firing rates to be the same.
So that get that point. So you ask, what if you have heterogeneity in the goal, right? Right. But this is just to answer your question. So you can use different kind of heterogeneities. This is before scaling, but curvature is the mean speed for the drift, and this is after. So the drift goes away, the systematic drift after scaling.
Why does it work? It works because if there were bias, then the average firing rates of the neurons at the bottoms of the potential will be higher.
That's right.
So you want to have.
Just correct it. Yeah. So this is one example where you have all kinds of heterogeneity. This is a big enough network, 4,000 cells, and there's also heterogeneity in the goal. Okay, 10% of
still
the
external inputs are the same for
you. Yes.
Because if they were different, then you would not expect the cells to have the same rate.
I don't think so. So you can change, for example, you can have heterogeneity in the input rate of the baselines, external input. This would still work.
And what you can worry about is that you could still end up in a situation where the average rates were equal, but the bump was lower amplitude at the bottom of the well and higher amplitude outside the well. So you'd still have drift, but the bump would start out high and then it would get shorter as it went down into the well. Right. I mean, this is.
And. But the well,
imagine another situation where the average rates of all the neurons could be the same, and yet there could still be drift. Right?
Yeah.
You could have a large bump that gets smaller when it drifts.
Yeah, so it does have to do with, for example, how long is the delay, then how much time you spend in the well, and all that. But so let me say that this actually does work, even if the goal rate.
You're proposing the way that this doesn't work.
Yeah.
It says it works.
How robust is it? Okay.
Yeah, so this actually has to do with robustness. So if you have heterogeneity in the goal rate, so not every cell has to reach the same goal, okay?
What do you mean with heterogeneity in the goal?
So, the scaling equation goes like this, tau. Right? So before, it's the same goal firing rate that everybody has to reach. Then you say, you just replace one homogeneity by another.
This is
hours to days. Yeah.
We simulated it for hours.
No, we had a trick. You can actually replace this by a spatial average, under some assumptions. So you say this is not fair, right? Because this is homogeneity now, right? Now let's introduce a heterogeneity in this F go across cells with a sigma that's 10% of the mean, right? And it still works, you know, pretty well.
But in complex distribution of spontaneous activity, it's much broader. It's like if you can get the expansion
across cells, yeah, that's true. So let me show you actually what in that particular case, what do you get? We get something like this. I don't know if this is good enough. So this is a spontaneous firing rate across different cells in the presence of heterogeneity. Right? You know, I think it's kind of quite reasonable in terms of the range, but maybe you can feed that by exponential. Another thing is that because the cells actually are not really the same now, the tuning curves are very different. You can have those are individual tuning curves from different cells. Okay?
So this is after the correction?
After scanning, yeah. After scanning.
I just want to understand, the external inputs are now not the same. Also the
No, external input is always
still the same.
Statistically the same, right? So those are Poisson input with the same rate to everybody.
So this should be preserved for these hours if this mechanism is to work.
Right, again, I mean, if it changes slowly in time?
Well, you can expect
it. Or just different from cell to cell.
The rate is so stationary.
Right.
External inputs are so stationary over the.
That's right. But certainly, I think if the rate, external rate is different from cell to cell with heterogeneity, I think it would still work. We can test that. The reason
it work if it's keeps if it's quenched again.
If it's quenched,
but how
yes.
How can it be quenched for this? Quenched.
So how would you do it? I mean, you want it to fluctuate, drift slowly in time.
Probably, yeah. It should be robust. If this is to work, it should be robust to some.
It depends on how you assume this. The point is that this is so slow, you really integrate. Okay? All it matters is the average over many days.
Yeah, but imagine now I reshuffle a little bit the external inputs, I would have to wait for hours until this mechanism is corrected. Otherwise, in the middle, in the intermediate time, it won't work. Until this has a chance to correct it.
Yeah, you know, we actually thought about something even more dramatic. You know, if, for example, if you have a real experiment, right, if you present to monkey a biased sample of this Q, only, you know, more probability with the Qs on the right, not on the left, then this mechanism will not give you the homogeneous, will not homogenize the network.
Yeah.
Right? And then what happens? You know, maybe.
But a small bias shouldn't. If a small heterogeneity of that didn't have an effect, you think the small bias.
Yeah, but I think it provides some kind of learning mechanism. So suppose that you present Q only on this side of the hemisphere. What happens? Then this will not. It will create something that's not homogenized.
This model would predict if you showed only things on the left. Drift would be to the right, because those firing rates get cranked up and the one on the left get cranked down. Is that correct? Is that the correct prediction? That's not.
Yeah. After you create the bias,
no, not necessarily. No, not necessarily, because the cells over here would, you know, have.
On average, the cells, it's hard to say. If you present on the left, on average, the cells on the right fire less.
Right.
So the G parameter goes up.
Right.
And therefore, the higher G means you're attracted over to the ones on the right. This is probably inconsistent with what experiments would show.
Well, if you do the experiment.
Definitely the experiment.
Yeah, what happens if you present only eight directions? That's another nice.
Say the ones in between. It just drift away from those eight directions.
Yeah, but so much you do the experiments.
I mean, they sort of did the experiments, right? I mean, you showed longer and longer times, and you saw they could walk around each one, but you
not systematic.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll start to think about how you do this kind of test, but this is not the only thing in the brain, right?
Right. I mean,
this is just one way to homogenize, to try to improve the problem, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is one last slide about this. Just show that when you have all kinds of heterogeneity, if you have scanning, this is what happens. So this is what happens when you don't have scanning. This is what happens after scanning. You see that the drift speed is independent of the standard deviation with the amount of heterogeneity. Okay? Because basically the scaling takes care of the all kind of heterogeneity is independent of the sigma size. Okay, I'm done with part one. What should we do?
Part two can be done.
Half an hour.
What's part two?
Part two is about perceptual decision making. So the idea is that this kind of network dominated by NMDA receptors gives you very slow remodulation. And it's very different from the other models where you want a very fast response to stimulus. What you want to have here is very slow ramping up kind of thing. And that can be used for perceptual decision making when the input is very ambiguous, for example.
We should schedule another informal.
One of the afternoons.
In one of the afternoons this week.
Yes. Okay.
So it'll be fresh.
So I have two questions first. So the connectivity was always homogeneous in all these models? And all these simulations. Do you ever consider heterogeneity in the connectivity?
Not yet.
Okay. Question number one. Question number two. I've found it's not so easy to have an attractor, in the sense that you increase the connectivity, increase in your background decays. You see a lot. Same thing Nicholas saw. So you find the attractors existed in a small parameter regime where they were easier to get, or?
No, it's really robust. But I mean, it's relative, right? But I think one of the tricks that Leonard and Dynamit proposed is when you increase the excitation, the peak of the connectivity, you also decrease the tail so that you have some kind of balance between long-term depression and long-term potentiation. That really helps a lot to get this kind of.
So the periodic boundary condition also looks problematic here, right? Because you say you don't have columns, but if you have columns, so how would you mention that it should be closed in the loop?
Yeah, I mean, this is just because the experiment was done with a fixed eccentricity. But I'm sure. But it is open, interesting issue what happens when you have
it would be a problem.
Space.